Cluster Conversations, a podcast by Africa Multiple.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to our podcast discussion on LGBT rights in Africa. My name is Stephen Brown. I'm a professor of political science at the University of Ottawa in Canada. And this year I'm spending at the University of Bayreuth at the Africa Multiple Cluster. And I'm working on this issue, and I'm here today to talk about it with my host, whose name is Togo, and he will now introduce himself.
Okay, I'm Togo Kaime, and I'm professor of African Legal Studies at Bayreuth. And it's been a pleasure welcoming you to Bayreuth, Stephen, and working together on this topic. And I look forward to our conversation in this podcast on various topics relating to LGBTIQ plus protection on the continent.
So why don't we start with the issue of the topic and how touchy it is. So you've organized a speaker series, you called it one of several intractable problems in Africa. Several people say that, you know, LGBT plus rights or LGBT is un-African, homosexuality is un-African, transgender is un-African. And in fact, some people in the West use that as well, usually right-wing people saying, oh, you know, we shouldn't impose our culture on Africa and therefore want to turn a blind eye to human rights abuses in many countries. So maybe you could say a few words about that.
Yeah, this is the age-old question, whether homosexuality is African. And the argument goes that practices that we describe as being homosexual somehow are not African. My response to this has always been to sometimes make jokes, but in a serious way to convey a certain message. I mean, there are Africans that are homosexual. We know them. They say they are homosexual. So if we say homosexual is an African, then who are these people? If we exclude them from this being or existence, as African. So as a matter of fact, just looking at the facts themselves, I think we can contend with this particular issue. But on a more serious point, this claim has been made many times to impose a very conservative and often political view that is espoused by certain elites about how sexualities on the continent should be. It doesn't take so much to actually find out that many types of sexualities have existed on the continent. One just has to ask, you know, the right questions. In relation to this, I would go into our etymology. Words do not exist unless there's a reason for it. You know, you go into almost every culture on the continent, they have a word for homosexual or being gay or same-sex relationships. Why? Why would you have that if homosexuality is an African? So it means that in the worldview of Africans, homosexuality exists. What the debate misses is the fact that criminalization of same-sex relationships is actually colonial. It's something that was imposed, but then we have internalized these impositions to such an extent that we want to exclude, you know, those of our citizens that identify in this way from the enjoyment of their respective rights. So for me, this is an interesting question, only insofar as it reveals the politics of those that make these kinds of claims, because the evidence is very simple to access. They are homosexual people on the continent. They identify as such. Some are not allowed to identify openly, but we know that they exist. That's the first thing. And then just look at our languages. Why do they have these artifacts? Have these also been transported from the West? It's the colonial laws that have made this a contentious area of human rights protection. Yeah, I've spoken too much, but maybe you also have a perspective as an outsider looking at this question.
Yeah, I mean, obviously as an outsider, I have a different sense of authority or a different capacity to speak on this issue. But yes, and I mean, I agree with everything you say, obviously. And there is sort of oral history and anthropological work from pre-colonial times that shows that there were female husbands and boy wives. And I would add that also in many African cultures, there's a kind of third gender or gender, non-binary gender that's often linked to spirituality and healing. You know, in South Africa, Sankoma, or so that kind of figure exists in very many African cultures. So, I mean, the modern label for that, you know, would be transgender or non-binary, but I'm not too hung up on labels. It's just a recognition that sexual and gender minorities have existed for a very long time, and that, yes, colonialism erased it, and colonialism brought with it, in most cases in Africa, Christianity, and sort of the values of those times, so Victorian values, yes. Victorian morality, mm-hmm. And because so many of the African cultures were not, their languages were not written down, traditions were oral history, it was easier to erase,
yes.
This history, and to the point where many Africans think they're being anti-colonial by resisting LGBT rights, but other people would argue that actually recognizing sexual and gender diversity is a form of decolonization.
Yes, very much, very much. And this is, for me, the enduring frustration that I have with colonialism, that most of these normative frameworks that were transported are so difficult to dislodge, even in favor of more human rights friendly practices that are embedded within our local cultures. We speak a little bit more about these pathways to LGBTIQ protection later in this podcast, but it's this enduring persistence that colonial law has across the continent that I see as a major impediment to protection in this area.
So maybe we can talk a little bit about the process of overturning these colonial laws.
Yes.
So I have a particular interest in this topic.
Yes.
And there are countries like Botswana where, and actually let me just back up a little bit. So much what we hear about Africa are the bad things. We hear about terrible laws that get passed in places like Uganda, mm-hmm. One that's currently been being debated in Ghana, where there are extremely harsh penalties for being gay, for knowing someone who's gay and not reporting them to the police, yes. For publicly saying that it's okay to be gay or LGBT.
Yes.
And we hear stories about activists being murdered and
yeah, more recently in Kenya.
Yeah. And this sort of gives a certain image, yeah. Of the state of LGBT rights in Africa. But there's also the opposite trend. So many countries have actually legalized homosexuality. Lusophone African countries, Portuguese-speaking African, yes. Countries, have sort of in a top-down kind of way, just sort of changed their laws. Like Mozambique, Angola, and a, yes. Few others. They just reformed their criminal codes and just did away with the laws that prohibited same-sex relations. Yeah. In other countries, there have been some court cases. So strategic litigation, where people take a case to a court and work their way up through appeals. And in Botswana, for instance, they actually succeeded in getting the colonial era law against homosexuality overturned. And this was approved on appeal. So this is a very interesting way to get rid of these laws based on national constitutions, which protect privacy, protect dignity, protect people from non-discrimination, all of which apply to these laws. So it's not surprising that these laws get overturned in a certain sense. But it doesn't always work. In Kenya, it failed. And it's going to be appealed, so it actually might succeed in the near future. You're a human rights lawyer, you're a law professor, you focus on human rights. You've been doing some work on Malawi.
Yes.
And the use of court. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. So this area gives me a lot of hope. And this is because most of these former British colonies adopted a common law system of judicial reasoning. And what it means is that the courts are almost constantly in conversation with each other. So for cases like the one you referred to from Botswana, where decriminalization was mandated by the court, looking at provisions of the constitution that are very similar to other provisions in Malawi, in Zambia, Lesotho, you know, all these African nations that have got bills of rights, it means that the judges, when these cases are presented before them, will have to have a look at what the courts in these jurisdictions have decided to influence or inform their decisions. So that kind of judicial conversation for me is very, very important. I know that we've had a conservative bench across many of these jurisdictions, but things are changing. And because of the training of the judges and all of that, I think we have more opportunity for change through this judicial strategy. So strategic litigation, yes, there have been some fails, but I think in the end we'll see jurisprudence actually confirming what is correct at international law. And again, that's another point. And most of these jurisdictions actually put primacy for international law. So it means that international human rights instruments, protections that focus specifically on LGBTQI plus minorities, will also take precedence in the constitution.
There's also the African Charter.
Yes, I was. Yes.
Ah, okay.
Yes. So here things are not so certain because we must also look at the realpolitik of the commission that has got the responsibility of ensuring that states are keeping to their obligations within the charter. But this is our premier human rights institution. It works alongside the African Court on Human Rights. A lot of their cases on different things have been really, really innovative. You know, this is a commission that wasn't given much chance when it was established, and yet it has gone on to pronounce so many leading cases on many topics, you know, from socioeconomic rights, how we protect socioeconomic rights in the constitution, on sustainable development, on rights of disabled peoples, indigenous peoples' rights. Pronouncements that are world leading. So I am assured that if these cases are ever taken before the Commission or the African Court of Human Rights, we are going to see a very similar approach, because I have noticed that in the latest jurisprudence, the Commission is not just writing to the litigants, you know, these are letters to the nations, you know, looking at international law and saying, okay, this is how we see these protections in relation to African peoples. And there's no doubt in my mind that the Commission sees our LGBTQI plus citizens. They give them a place, observer status in the proceedings of the Commission and all of that, because they, you know, the Commission recognizes the urgent need for protection for this, you know. So strategic litigation, judicial measures within the states themselves, but also these supranational mechanisms that we have within the African human rights system, I think should give us hope, you know, that we will see better protection emerge in the coming years. Okay, so when we have spoken about this topic, I've often asked you about how you see yourself in this space, talking about LGBTQI plus rights in Africa, being white, you're from Canada. I mean, how do you see your place?
So that's always a tricky issue. And one way I deal with that is I look at the role of international actors, including Canada. So most of my work for the past 25 years has been on foreign aid. So I'm looking at the intersection of international and national actors, mostly in Africa. And so I feel that my role is more criticizing my own government or Western governments on what they are doing or not doing or should be doing or shouldn't be doing. Because though I'm in favor of supporting African organizations and individuals in defending their rights, I'm less keen on the kind of bullhorn diplomacy that we've seen in the past. Great pronouncements, condemnations. Mm-hmm. And the problem with that are, the problems are many. One is sort of the hierarchy, the lecturing, the patronizing, and the sort of the presentation of the West as being evolved and Africa as being more primitive and not being evolved and thinking about things like rights, and that's not a helpful dynamic. But also it's not very effective. So you know, the more Western countries harangued some African, some Ugandan politicians, yes, the more determined they were to pass their law. And there are some cases where they have influenced outcomes. One was in Malawi. There was a case of an LGBT couple that was sentenced, yes, to 14 years of hard labor for, yes, having a traditional betrothal ceremony.
Yes.
Which maybe you can tell me, I don't even know if that's legal. I mean, to give them 14 years of hard labor because they weren't accused of homosexuality. So I'm not sure that the anti-homosexuality law applies. But anyway, they were sentenced. There was a lot of international outcry. The UN Secretary General was visiting Malawi. I think it was Ban Ki-moon.
Yes.
And just before he arrived, the president pardoned them. So that seemed to be like a sign that international pressure was effective. But then what happened is when all the international actors went home or the international media stopped watching, Malawi passed two new laws that further entrenched,
yes,
anti-homosexuality laws and penalties. and I can't remember the details, extended it to female homosexuality as well.
Yeah, say to for gender equality purposes.
Ironically.
Yes.
Yeah. So there are several cases like that where, you know, international involvement has been ineffective at best and sometimes counterproductive. I'm trying to think about and write about non-imperialistic ways of supporting LGBT rights in Africa. And to sum it up, I would say is just support local groups.
Yes.
Like follow their strategies. Yes. If they want to things to be said publicly, then you can say things publicly. Yes. And if they don't want you to say things publicly because that may endanger their life or for other reasons it doesn't seem like a good strategy, well then don't. And it's hard for foreign aid donors to do that because they like to claim credit. Yes. They like to report back. They like to put things on their website. They like to announce who they supported. If they're going to sponsor a reception for, you know, the International Day Against Homophobia, Biphobia, and Transphobia, they want to have it at the embassy. They want to have a photographer. Yes. And that's not always in the interest of local activists. And so the things I think they should do, they will often be hesitant to do because they want the visibility, they want to be able to claim the credit. I'm Canadian. Canada likes to put the maple leaf and the Canadian flag on things and to claim credit. And so what I would say instead is you have to work with local partners, you have to trust them, not necessarily give them carte blanche. There has to be some kind of accountability. You have to have some sort of sense whether this group is actually working well or not, or is, you know. But follow their lead, support them in their strategies. They know the context. They should have ownership. They shouldn't be following the donor's priorities. Money should be given as core funding, not just to fund special activities like a film festival, but money that they can run an office and have a PO box or a phone line or, you know, cell phones or something, pay for their website and to embed LGBT plus rights in other human rights. So it can't be portrayed as like special rights.
Yes.
Because that's a danger, because it makes it seem like if the donors only care about the gays or something. But I mean, donor countries don't only care about the gays and they don't necessarily care about the gays a whole lot either. But if they care about all marginalized communities, including women who are the majority, then, you know, focusing not so much on LGBT rights per se, but on the principles of dignity and privacy and upholding those equality. Principles.
Yeah.
So I think that's a more productive approach. And so that's where I see my own work coming in as a non-African.
Okay. You've led us very well to what I would like to be our last point. And this focuses on, you know, pathways to better protection for LGBT QI plus minorities. What are your thoughts?
I think we need a portfolio approach. We need to do many things at the same time. And as I was just saying, it's up to local human rights defenders to decide what's the priority, what the right mix is, and so on. In some cases, you know, strategic litigation might be really effective. But also, strategic litigation or court cases aren't only about the merits of the case. Like, judges don't just look at the law and say this is constitutional, yes or no. They're influenced by public opinion.
Yes.
And some judgments actually even say, you know, our citizens are not ready for this, which, as a non-lawyer, I find actually quite strange that that becomes an argument. But so many complementary things can be done to help move along public opinion. That can involve working with journalists to help them present issues of homosexuality or transgender or LGBTI plus rights in a more, I hesitate to say favorable, but I mean at least neutral way to not be scandalous about it. Working with the police to make sure that people's rights are respected, that you can't arbitrarily detain someone or torture them just because you suspect they may be gay. I think it's worth pointing out that Actually, almost nobody is ever convicted under anti-homosexuality laws in the sense that it's the sexual act that's illegal, and not being gay, not saying you're gay, not advocating gay rights. None of that is illegal in most countries. I mean, these new laws might change that. But basically, if two people are having sex in private, where's the proof? And the fact that individuals can be arrested for suspected homosexuality, well, were they homosexual? Like, did they have homosexual acts all by themselves? Like, they had to have had, you know, a partner. So working with police, also working with religious leaders, in having difficult discussions about what religions actually say, what scripture actually says. Very interestingly, the Pope recently came out and said homosexuality should not be illegal. It's not a crime. He said it's a sin, which, you know, we won't have a theological debate here.
No.
but he has said it's not a crime. Mm-hmm. So even the Pope, the head of the Catholic Church, which is not a staunch defender of LGBT plus rights, has said it should not be illegal. Mm-hmm. So I think work can be done with religious leaders in Muslim-dominated countries as well. I mean, there is a sort of queer theology branch of Islam. So I think productive conversations could be had there. But these are things that take time. You know, maybe a generation, but I mean, if we look at the West and if we look at the changes, even in Canada in my lifetime, just how we've moved from, you know, not allowing LGBT people even to serve in the civil service, to having same-sex marriage.
Yes.
Attitudes can change very quickly.
I think so. I agree. And you raise an important point here in that legitimacy actually requires deep work. You know, going to court, filing papers. Yes, I mean, for lawyers, this is really important, crucial work. But it's part of what needs to be done. Difficult or challenging problems of human rights like this require conversations across, you know, the whole spectrum of society, and you can't do this by funding a film festival, for example, or funding this other small piece of work here and there. You can't get traction. So the conversation must, you know, bring all society along in their respective fields. And this might be church, it might be in social clubs and all of that. So it's going to take a lot of effort to move this.
Working with traditional authorities as well, customary authorities, chiefs, could also...
Because they have more authority than the law recognizes.
Yeah. And there might be important traces of oral history in communities that remember the practices that colonial authorities try to erase, basically.
Yes.
And to a large extent, succeeded.
Yeah. Okay, great. So,
shall we wrap up here?
Yeah, I think it's enough work for us to do over the next couple of years. And
all right.
Yeah, I hope we realize the protections that are already there and they just need to be taken. So, yeah, it is really nice having this conversation with
you. Well, thank you, Toko, and thank you to the Africa Cluster at the University of Bayreuth for hosting us, and thank you to our listeners.